All right, so it's a great pleasure to have Yohei Emma telling us about Higgs inflation today. Yohei is a postdoc at University of Minnesota, and as we just discussed, he may come to visit us later this year. So please go ahead, Yohei.
Yeah, so thank you for the introduction. And of course, thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about our recent work at Parameter Institute. And I hope I can visit there physically at some point within this year. Okay, so the title of my talk is Higgs inflation, unitarity, and emergence of scalarum. And as Matthias said, my name is Yohei Emma. I'm now working as a postdoc at the University of Minnesota. And this talk is going to be based on this, these works in collaboration with Ryusuke Jinno, Kazumi Nakayama, Kyohei Mukaira, and Yoin Van Davis. And I also wrote several other works related to this topic. So if you find my talk today interesting, then maybe you want to also check these papers. Okay, so let me proceed. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about a Higgs inflation. So within this slide, I will briefly review what is the Higgs inflation, just to be sure that we are on the same page. So the Higgs inflation, of course, identifies the standard model Higgs, or actually the radial model of the standard model Higgs as the inflaton. But you know, if you use just the standard model Higgs potential, that is the quadratic potential, then at least the tensor to scale ratio is too large compared to the CMB observation. So that means that you have to modify the shape of the potential in the large feedback region, because the inflation happens in the large feedback region. So you have to somehow modify the shape of the potential. And I think there are several ways of doing that, of course, but one of the most popular way, let's say, is to introduce a non-minimal coupling to gravity, which I call C in this talk. Okay, so the Lagrangian is given by this. So here and MP is the Planck scale, and phi I is the Higgs field. So here I, so this phi I denotes the real degrees of freedom of the Higgs. So the real scalar fields, this phi I is, and this R is the Ritz scalar. And as you can see that you can introduce the coupling between the phi I scale, the Higgs scale, and the Ritz scalar. And the coefficient, I will call this coefficient as C. Okay, so as I said, the phi r is the Higgs, and in the case of the standard model Higgs, Higgs is the SU2 doublet. So in terms of the real degree of freedom, you know, Higgs has four components. So this I runs from 1 to 4, but in particular in the second part, I'm going to take this number of the real scalar fields to be ns. So I'm going to just take to be ns in the second part, but in the case of the standard model Higgs, that this is equal to 4. Okay, and r is the Ritz scalar, as I said. So this is the Lagrangian. And it is, I think it is well known that this model is really consistent with the CMB observation so far. If the Xi and lambda, so lambda is the Higgs quadratic coupling, and the Xi and lambda satisfies this kind of relation. Okay. So Xi squared is equal to 2 × 10⁹ times lambda. So this in particular means that unless lambda is tiny, like if lambda is over, 10⁻¹ or 10⁻², then a Xi must be of the order of 10⁴ or 4. And that means that the Xi must be really large, larger than unity. So in this talk, I will assume that the Xi is indeed much larger than unity. Okay. So this is, as I said, this is true unless lambda is tiny. So actually here you should use the lambda at the inflationary scale, not at the, for instance, electric scale. So you have to include the running, the effect of the running. And if you sort of, let's say, tune the top Koch mass, for instance, then you can make lambda to be really tiny at the inflation scale. And that kind of scenario is called the critical Higgs inflation scenario. But I would not consider that scenario in this talk, okay? So I will just take lambda to be like 0.1 or 0.01, not so tiny, so that the C is large. So let's say I will consider just the binary Higgs inflation model, okay? And once this, relation is satisfied, then the CMB prediction of the Higgs inflation is within this region. Sorry, maybe this is too small, but this is the spectral index. The x-axis is the spectral index, and y-axis is the tensor to scale ratio. And Higgs inflation, the prediction of the Higgs inflation is within this region. So this is really consistent with the CMB observation so far. Okay, so because of this consistency, and also because of the minimality, let's say, because you don't have to introduce any additional degree of freedom to have the inflaton. So I think this is one of the most popular model, inferential model so far. So I'm going to consider this model in detail in the following.
Sorry, can I ask you a question about...
Sure.
So this is not... the field phi is not canonical, it couples to R. So what happens if you go to the Einstein frame here?
So in the Einstein frame, you don't have any of this kind of coupling.
Yes.
And then the price to pair is that your target space, so you will have some coupling here, or your kinetic time becomes non-trivial. I will explain that a bit more.
You'll talk about later? Okay, if you talk
about
then.
Yeah. I'll talk about that later. Okay, and then, so first I say that Higgs inflation is really nice, but actually there is a problem, and that is called the unitarity issue of Higgs inflation. So I'm gonna explain what is that in this slide, okay? So as I said, I assume that there exists a large C, because this is kind of required from the same B. And the large C, it is known that large C actually induces a three-level unitarity variation of Higgs inflation, or it lowers the cutoff scale of the Higgs inflation, okay? And that is pointed out by these people. And I think there are still several ways of seeing this, but for me, the most straightforward way of seeing it is to just compute some physical quantities and how the physical quantities depend on C. So I'm gonna consider scattering amplitude and how the scattering amplitude depend on C, okay, in the following. So once you have this coupling C, then there exists a scalar graviton vortex induced from this non-minimum coupling. Okay, so that is given by this. So here H is the metric, or actually the trace part of the metric. And you just have this trilinear interaction or cubic interaction, whatever. And this depends on C. And with this vortex, you can compute a 4-point scattering amplitude, like a 2-2-2 scattering amplitude between phi I and phi j. And let's say that I and j are different. Then you have to consider only the S-channel process, and then that is given by this diagram, and that you can easily compute, and you will get this result, okay? And here, the important point is that, there is this factor, okay? So because C is really large, so this is sort of proportional to C scale, okay? And because of this term, the three-level unitarity is actually evaluated at this energy scale. So, sorry, here S and T and U are bounded down variable. So S is kind of the center of mass and energy of this scattering. And if that energy scale exceeds this scale, like M Planck divided by C, then the unitarity, two-level unitarity is violated, because if the energy scale is larger than this value, then the amplitude becomes larger than, let's say, one. And the unitarity, roughly speaking, tells you that the amplitude cannot exceed one. So this means that the two-level unitarity is violated at this scale. And because C is large, this is much smaller than the M Planck. So the cutoff scale is lowered because of the large C, large non-minimum coupling. Okay, so this is the so-called unitarity issue of Higgs inflation. And here I have to say that I computed the scattering amplitude only around the vacuum, like only around the point where the Higgs doesn't have any dip. Okay, and there depends on whether this is a problematic during inflation. And actually, it is known that it could be fine during inflation, because during inflation, Higgs actually has a dip, because Higgs is an inflaton, so it rolls down from the large field variation, so it has a finite dip. So you have to consider the cutoff scale in the large field variation, and that is actually higher than this value, so it could be fine during inflation with the finite dip. So that is what these people say. And I think still there are some people who are, I don't say against, but who are still concerning the unitarity issue during inflation a bit more. But my attitude in this talk is that I don't care too much about a unitarity issue during inflation, because actually it is known that even if it is okay during inflation, actually it is problematic after inflation during the preheating epoch. Okay, so I'm gonna expand this part in detail in later. So what I want to say is that even if the Higgs inflation is okay during inflation, after inflation, actually the Higgs inflation bar is unitary. So you actually produce a Longchamp model of the gauge bosons quite efficiently. And a typical momentum scale of those Longchamp model of the gauge bosons is larger than the cutoff scale. So that means that it is really problematic after inflation during preheating epochs. I will explain this part later, so you don't worry. You don't have to worry about that. But you know, this is the kind of the known fact. So I want to think a bit more about the entire issue of Higgs inflation. So this is the main motivation of my talk. Okay. So,
just a very naive question. Like, how does the is there an easy way to see how the VEV solves the unitarity issue? Like, or is it just?
So what you have to do is you have to compute the scattering amplitude with the VEV, and I don't know whether there is an easy way of seeing that. And then you can just study the scattering amplitude with the finite VEV, and then you can actually see that the cutoff scale becomes higher than this value. But easy way. So I think one way of thinking is that, for instance, if you have some particle that is coupling to the Higgs, Higgs scale and the phi scale, and let's say that mass scale of that particle is like m around the vacuum without Higgs VEV. Then the cutoff scale, so if you integral that particle, then the cutoff scale of your theory becomes just the m, right? The mass scale of that particle. But if the Higgs has a really large field value, large field value, then the mass scale of that particle becomes larger, right?
I see.
Then the cutoff scale can be higher.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not completely sure it is something that is happening in this specific example, but in general, I think if you have a finite VEV, then you can expect that the cutoff scale can be different. Yeah.
Can I add here? So
yeah, or actually, there is an author of this paper, right? So yes.
Yeah. Hi,
please.
So the argument is actually quite simple here. So I mean, if you want to see it intuitively, so if you go to Einstein frame, then the Higgs potential flattens out at very large Higgs VEVs. Yeah, because. That's what Mina suggested. Yeah, to go to normalize canonically the perturbations of the Higgs, and for this canonically normalized field, the potential flattens out, so interactions die off. And that is also true actually for all other interactions. If you assume that they kind of have the same structure, if they obey the shift symmetry, with respect to approximate shift symmetry with respect to shift of Higgs. So all interactions, they die off at large values of the Higgs, and that's why the cutoff is raised. So essentially, it becomes just set by Planck mass, but the cutoff of gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think you can see the shift. Yeah. So I think you can see the shift symmetry just from this coupling. So if phi I becomes really large, then you can just essentially just forget about this one. That means that you can essentially forget about the M Planck. Then there is no scale in this theory. So that's why. Yeah. Indeed.
Ask a question there.
Yes, sure.
So my understanding is that it's relaxed, but it's not relaxed to the Planck mass, but it's relaxed to M Planck divided by the square root of C. Is that, at least that was what people thought in the old days. Is that still something which is regarded as being true, or is that changed?
I think that is still true.
Right, I think this is, this is true for vector bosons. If you don't include vector bosons, just consider scalars and fermions, then it's Planck mass. But yeah, with vector bosons, massive vector bosons, yes, you get. I think that the vector boson, they have mass M Planck over square root of xi at inflation. So they set basically vector boson, massive vector bosons set the cutoff scale.
Which, if I remember correctly, was about the scale of the Higgs in Higgs inflation. Or...
Yes. I thought that the gauge bosons that mattered were the standard model gauge bosons.
Standard model gauge bosons. Yes.
Yeah, standard model gauge bosons.
Sorry, go ahead.
So I think especially the Longchamp model of the gauge bosons are really important.
I see. So Sergey, your point is that if you're not talking about the standard model Higgs, but you're talking about like a scalar minimally coupled, like a Starobinsky inflation or something, then it would be M Planck.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe I can also mention that. So here, actually, I'm taking I and J to be different. Because it is really important that you have two more than one real scalar degree of freedom here in this analysis. Because if you have only one scalar field, then not only this H channel, but you also have T channel and U channel processes. So this S will be something like S plus T plus U, and that vanishes without any mass term. So in order for this C to be really physical, then you need more than one real scalar field. Okay, so without potential. So if you include potential, then the story is different. And here, I'm just considering the energy boson. So if you one of these scalars energy bosons in the case of the Solomon Higgs, because it is gauge, right? But then the Lonkishan model of the gauge boson plays the same role as the energy bosons. So it is really important to include the Lonkishan model of the gauge bosons within this analysis. That is crucial.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so any questions? Any other questions? Okay, then I'm gonna proceed. So the outline is the following. So the introduction part is done. And then next, I will discuss the, in the section two, I will discuss the unitary variation during preheating a bit more in detail as I advertised. And then in the section three, I'm gonna study the unitary structure of Higgs inflation by using large N limit. Okay, so here N is the number of the real scalar field. And then I will summarize my talk. Okay, so this is the outline. And I have to say that this section two is more like cosmology, and this section three is more like GFT-ish. So I feel like the style of the talks are really different between this section two and section three. So maybe you have to switch your brain a bit between this section two and section three. But of course, they are closely related to each other. But maybe it is helpful to mention this, like how to say the topics. Topics are the same, but the styles are really different in this section two and section three. Okay, so I'm gonna proceed. So I'm gonna explain the unitary variation during preheating. Okay. So first of all, I'm gonna consider the inflaton dynamics after inflation during the preheating epoch. And then after inflation, of course, the inflaton or the Higgs rolls down towards the bottom of its potential and then oscillates around the bottom of its potential. Okay, so I'm gonna consider that inflaton oscillation regime. Okay, and so first of all, I think this is an answer to the previous question. So first of all, you can just study the system in whatever frame you want. You can also study the system in the Jordan frame, but I think it is better to go to the Einstein frame because people are used to this frame. So once you go to the Einstein frame, then the Higgs spheres has a non-trivial target space like this. So you can just get rid of the nominal coupling to the gravity by performing a Fourier transformation. So once you do that, then you can just drop all the nominal coupling here. But then the price to pay is that your kind term now becomes really complicated like this. So this HAB is the target space metric, and that is given by this. Okay. So here, omega is given by this formula, and it depends on xi. And here, phi is the radial mole of the Higgs, and chi is one of the energy moles of the Higgs, okay? So in the case of the Higgs, actually, we have three energy moles. Like, you can just assign, write down chi one and chi two and chi three, but so even if you include three energy bosons, then the argument and the discussion in the following is the same. So here, just for simplicity, I will focus on one energy mole. Okay, so it is really, as I said, it is really important that you have 2 degrees of freedom, but once you have more than one real, degree of freedom, then it doesn't matter too much whether you have two or three or four. Okay, so I'm gonna consider just, I'm gonna focus on this specific energy mole, or this, just one component. Okay, so in the Einstein frame, the kind of time becomes really non-trivial. And as I said, I'm gonna consider the inflaton oscillation regime. Okay, so the potential, Higgs potential is something like this. And in the large field variation, the inflation happens, okay? But then at some point, the Higgs rolls down towards the bottom of the potential. And at some point, the inflation ends, and it starts to oscillate like this, okay? And that actually happens with this field value. But then, actually from this target space metric, you can see that there is a tiny region around the bottom, around the origin of the potential, where the kinetic term of the Higgs changes drastically. So you can actually look at this term, okay? And if phi, the field value of phi is larger than M Planck divided by xi, so within this region, and this term actually dominates the kinetic term over this term because this omega scale is just of order one, okay? But once it approaches to the origin at some point, then this term becomes no longer important, and this term becomes more important. Okay, so from this, you can actually see that the kinetic term drastically changes within this field value. So there is a tiny region around the origin, we had a kinetic term of the Higgs that drastically changes. Okay. And because of this, actually there exists a spiky feature for this region. And this actually causes the HID variation. And this whole argument may sound a bit hand-waving because I'm not saying anything, right? So I'm just saying that this term becomes less important around the origin. So, but you can just convince yourself that this argument is really true just by numerically solving the dynamics of the Higgs, okay? So this is the numerical solution of the Higgs. So this phi is the radial model of the Higgs. So it oscillates after impression like this. Oh, sorry, like this. But then if you plot, for instance, the phi of the velocity of phi, then actually it shows those kind of spiky features. So you can easily see that those spikes, right? And these spikes are corresponding to the point where the phi crosses origin. And then the origin of those spikes are really because of this drastic change of the kinetic time. Okay. And because the time scale of these spikes are really tiny, actually this causes the entire diversion. Actually the time scale of those spikes are so the inverse time scale of those spikes are larger than the cuff scale of the theory. So it actually causes the HID variation, as I will explain in the next slide. Okay.
Sorry, I have a question about sure. I have a bigger question. So it's confusing to think in these spaces because things are not canonically normalized and things like that. So if I go to the Einstein frame, what happens? And also, I mean, you go through a regime where unitarity is explicitly violated. I mean, doesn't that mean that the theory is not under control anymore, so you cannot even do this? I'm just confused.
Okay, so about your first question, so you want to canonically normalize all the fields?
Yeah.
That's what you mean. But so first of all, you can't do it. Because you can compute the curvature from this metric. So you can, for instance, canonically normalize the radial model of the Higgs, but you cannot canonically normalize the phi and chi at the same time. So that is really important.
No, that's just a... That
no, you cannot do that.
The mix, right? So you need to do...
Yeah, mix this.
Yeah, so it's a complicated transformation.
Okay, so in order to answer your question, you can compute a curvature from this target space metric, okay? And then that curvature is actually non-zero.
It's a non-linear theory at this point, so you cannot easily canonically re-diagonalize it, right?
Okay, then it could...
You can't do it for all phi, but you can do it at a specific point, right? You just choose Gaussian normal coordinates, and you can make the metric diagonal...
At one point, yes. But right? You're going to make it completely flat in all the points.
But I think Mina is asking the question, if you're supposing you go to Gaussian coordinates and you canonically normalize at the particular value of the field that you're talking about, what happens
so
there?
So in a we are doing that in a sense, because this is just the canonical normalize at the origin. If you take a phi and chi to be zero, then it is just canonically normalized at the origin. So we are in a sense taking the Gaussian coordinate, Gaussian normal coordinate at the origin.
So can I, let me ask if this is the same thing as what you're saying. So, there's the criterion for a low energy effective theory that we normally use in particle physics assumes that the fields involved are static. But if you have a time dependent background field, then there's additional criterion that an effective theory has to satisfy, such as that field dot divided by field, that scale to do with the time dependence is also has to be small compared to with the UV scale. Is the thing that's happening here in your unitarity violation that there's because phi is going through zero, that kind of a quantity is becoming large? Is that what's happening?
Yeah. So actually I'm not completely caring about the size of the phi dot.
What count would be phi dot over phi. And you said that phi is passing through zero. So because phi dot over phi would be characterized by the time dependent scale and not the scale of phi itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so is the specific unitarity violation?
Okay, so in a sense, yes. So maybe I can explain the next slide and then you will see a bit more about that. I think I'm talking about that, I think, the next slide.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so any other questions? If not, so I can proceed. And then, as I said, these spiky features causes the utility variation. And I think there is an easy way, easy to use condition of utility variation from target space. So in this slide, I'm going to explain how the utility variation actually happens. Okay, so so actually it is really important that energy bosons efficiently produced from the spikes. Okay, and then actually it is the energy boson production that you know, varies the initiality. Okay, so I'm gonna explain how that happens in this slide. So energy boson, first of all, has a mass term from the target space curvature. So the energy boson, the mass of the energy boson is given by this. Okay, so this formula. And here, there exists a term that depends on tidal scale. And then the coefficient of that term is you know, given by the curvature of the target space metric. Okay. And this looks a bit complicated, maybe, but I was just saying that, you know, if you have, for instance, this coupling like a chi scale, is coupling to the delta phi scale, then you will get the couplings, which is something like this, like M chi scale. Is just you can just say that this term is the mass term for the chi particle, and the M chi scale is just given by this. Okay, and then you know, there are also other contributions, but you can just combine all those contributions, and then you will just end up with the curvature. So this is a bit more sophisticated way of saying, you know, you will get the mass term from this coupling. Okay. And maybe I can also mention that actually the energy boson has a mass term, because here I'm considering the time-dependent background. Like, you know, symmetry breaking field is time-dependent. So because of that, the energy boson actually has a mass term. And as I you know, said previously, like this phi dot is actually spiky. So because of this mass term, energy boson field is the spikes. Okay. And as I said, the infraton motion changes for this value, and then the curvature of the target space is given by this. So here, in the case of the Higgs impression, lambda is given by M Planck divided by C. And you can estimate a typical momentum scale of this infraton motion of the spike, okay? So, and then you can estimate a typical momentum scale of the spike in the following way. So first of all, you know, there is a tiny region here, lambda, where the kind of term changes. And then the time scale is just given by the field value divided by the phi dot at the origin. So I think this is exactly the same as the previous question. So this is the estimation of the time scale. And then the inverse of this time scale is given by, the inverse of this time scale gives you the typical momentum scale of this spike, okay? And that is given by this formula. And the cutoff scale, it's also given by lambda, because the curvature, the target space curvature affects, for instance, scattering amplitude. So the scattering amplitude is given by the curvature of the target space, because that must be covariant under the field redefinitions. Okay. So you have to compare this case, spike and lambda, to see whether there exists a unitary variation. But then there is this phi dot at the origin, but you can just estimate the velocity of the inflaton at the origin by using the energy conservation law. Okay, so the phi dot at the origin should be sort of equal to the height of the potential at the end of the inflation, height of the inflaton potential at the end of the inflation. Okay, so here I just ignore the Hubbard parameter because we are considering the inflaton oscillation regime, so Hubbard parameter is not that important. And once you ignore the Hubbard parameter, then you can just say that this is sort of equal to this. And by using this condition, and by using this formula, you can compare this case spike and lambda. And the unitary variation, of course, happens when the case spike is larger than lambda. And this is translated to this condition. Like, height of the potential is larger than lambda to the fourth. So if this condition is met, then you can say that this case spike is larger than lambda. So there exists a unitary variation. Okay, so. And then I think this condition is really natural. It just simply compares the inflaton energy scale and the cutoff scale. Okay. So if the inflaton energy scale is larger than the cutoff scale of the theory, then you may say, like, you know, there must be something that some, you know, unitary variation should happen. And then here, in a sense that we really studied what is the, you know, explicit process that varies the unitarity. Okay. And in the case of the Higgs impression, so this ratio is given by lambda times C scale, okay? And if you use the CMB normalization, this is you know, kind of given by 10 to minus 9 times C to the fourth for the Higgs impression model. So if you take C to be larger than, let's say, 10 to 2 or 100, then it causes an HID variation, okay? And here we made a discussion.
May I ask you here? So yeah, I'm just trying to understand. So again, this argument, the singularity violation appears because of the longitudinal modes of the vector box.
Indeed. Yes.
So for example, yeah, we have some other theory where we don't have number goals to bosons. We just have a radial mode and maybe some fermions. Would we still have this problem or not?
So at least then the analysis becomes totally different. I think maybe there is no problem because, you know, this energy boson is coupled to the spikes really strongly because of this term. But if you consider fermions or other, you know, just a real scale appears that is minimum coupled to the gravity without any explicit interaction to the Higgs, then the production of those particles are not that efficient because they are not really coupling to the spikes strongly. So I would say that, you know, it is really important that you have energy bosons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see.
Or, you know, longitudinal model of the gauge bosons are really equivalent to the energy bosons. So
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can I follow up on that? Is it so the just can you show the previous slide where you show the spikes? So the spike really is in phi dot, it's not in phi dot over phi, is that right?
Yeah. So this is something like a phi dot over phi, let's say.
So when you say that there's, it's very odd behavior, right? In the sense that I don't have a very good physical understanding as to why phi dot spikes like that. I guess if I differentiate the left hand plot, it looks like it doesn't have anything particularly spiky. What is it that makes the right hand side so spiky?
Well, actually, this is just the derivative of this one.
Yeah, and so
if
where's
you
the
look really. I don't know how I can see from this, but I think here the dynamics must be really different. Yeah, and the reason is really because of this term.
I see. So when you say it's unitarity violation, in what sense is unitarity violated? That to me makes it sound like you've looked at scattering around some background, but that must be kind of tricky to do in a time-dependent background. So what is it that you actually,
Okay, so I can move to the next slide. So this is the result. So actually, because of the time-dependent background, you produce particles because your frequency is now time-dependent. And then there is a way of computing the spectrum of the produced particle. And then you know, you can just solve the system numerically and see what happens. And then this is the result. So this is just a numerical solution. So we just solve the dynamics numerically, okay? And we just computed the production of the chi particle energy bosons, and this is the spectrum of that. Okay,
because my question is just before that, but won't that mean that just there will be some back reaction or something so that the phi will stop rolling?
Sure. But important point is that in order to include those back, sure. So maybe I can also mention that in the next slide.
Okay.
So here x-axis is the momentum and y-axis is the energy density rescaled by the cutoff scale. But essentially this is the differential. D log rho d log k or something. But this is just a spectrum, the energy density, the spectrum of the energy density. And here we change we are calling this xi pi, but this is the same as xi. So we are just changing the value of xi, like 10 to 2 to 10 to 3, 10 to 4, okay? And the results are like this. And you can ignore those dotted lines because they're our semi-classical approximation of the spectrum, which we gave in this paper, but I don't have enough time to explain that point. So you can just ignore those, you know, dotted lines. So you can just focus on these solid lines. And as you can see that, so the cutoff scale is given by this point, okay? Because this is the, you know, k. So k is, you know, normalized by the cutoff scale. So this one is the cutoff scale, okay? And you can see that if you increase the xi to be 10 to 2 to 10 to 4, then the peak of this produced particles, the peak of the energy density of those produced particles just exceed the cutoff scale, okay? So this means that, so once you go beyond the cutoff scale, then you can no longer actually trust the theory because, you know, you have to include other terms and then, you know, you're gonna just trust those results. But what I want to say is that once it exceeds 10 to 2, then actually those kind of productions are really important. So in order to study the reheating or preheating of the Higgs impression, then you have to just UP-complete Higgs impression. So within a Higgs impression, you can answer what happens, okay, for those values. So that is the main point. And I can also estimate the energy density of the produced particle, and that is given by this. So that is just roughly speaking, just given by k back to the fourth, and that is given by this formula. And this is larger than the impression energy scale if the initial evaporation condition is met. So this means that this production is really kind of fatal. So yeah, it is true that the within this region, actually you have to also include back reactions of those produced particles to the inflaton. But in order to select back reaction, first you have to study what happens, what is the correct production of those particles, right? But then in order to study that, then you have to actually UV complete your theory. So that is my main point, okay? Because otherwise the typical momentum scale of those particles just exceed a cutoff scale. So you cannot just trust those analyses. So in order to really study what's going on during preheating or during preheating after impression, then you have to just UV complete Higgs impression. So there is actually a unitarity issue of Higgs impressions. So that is my main point here.
So can I ask, I'd like to understand it because it's a very interesting point you're making. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. so is there's a variety of things I can imagine could be going wrong. And so one of them would be you no longer have an adiabatic solution, so that your time dependence of your background is actually sampling a scale, which is what you've put in your UV sector. But another one could be that your spatial the spatial variation could be getting very spiky, and that could be something which is above the cutoff scale. And what's confusing me a little bit is that when you talk about K, I'm thinking that must be it sounds like you're looking at it as something which is fragmenting in space, whereas the way you described it originally, it sounded like I could understand the unitarity violation in terms of a homogeneous role. So can you clarify which is important?
Okay, so here what is important is the momentum of the produced particle. So the picture is something like this. So first you have the homogeneous condensation, that is the inflaton, and that is just the coherent ray oscillating. But because of this oscillation, the energy bosons are excited, okay? And these are just particles. So these are not homogeneous in any sense. So
sure.
Because of this oscillation, you will have just a bunch of those fluctuations. And then the typical energy scale and momentum scale of those fluctuations just exceed the cutoff scale of the theory. So the spatial gradient and also the time dependence of those fluctuations are just beyond the cutoff scale.
So I'm understanding that the momentum is coming in because you're looking at particle production, but the energy for that production you're extracting from the homogeneous role, right, of the background field.
Yes, indeed.
And is the basic problem that that phi dot is essentially becoming above the cutoff scale?
So the basic problem is the phi dot divided by this lambda and becomes larger than the cutoff scale. So that is the basic problem.
And what was lambda was the thing that was appearing in the metric.
Lambda is the M Planck divided by C, sorry. And this is sort of the curvature of the target space or the cutoff scale in the case of the Higgs impression. So as I said, this region the kinetic time changes drastically. So you're correct, I think. You have to just divide the phi dot. You have to just consider phi dot divided by pi. But then here phi, the typical scale of the field value is lambda or M Planck divided by C, because that region is really important.
Well, you can divide by lambda. So I think it's equivalent. I mean, your condition that you're considering that K spike becomes bigger than lambda, it's the same as saying that phi dot becomes bigger than lambda squared.
Yeah, indeed. And that's true.
These two problems are related to each other, it seems.
Right, but then that makes sense, right? Because that's actually very good. I'm glad you said that. So then I would have said that if you have a time dependent background, one of the things you require in order to believe that the effective theory is capturing things correctly is that scales like phi dot squared have to be smaller than, or phi dot have to be smaller than your cutoff scale squared. That's what's happening.
Indeed. So here the energy conservation implies that the phi dot scale at the origin should be equal to this inflation energy scale. So you can just use this relation to this, and you will see the phi dot scale.
I see.
Be smaller than lambda to the fourth, not to have any unitarity variation. Yeah, true. Sorry, I should have said that.
then it makes complete sense that you're seeing things break down, right? Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the end of the section two. So are there any further questions? Is it clear so far?
So since you stopped, so the take home message is the thing I should learn from this is what? So that the I should not trust calculations of particle production.
Okay,
in
so
this kind of a background.
Yeah. So my point is that the Higgs inversion varies in entirety after inversion, trying preheating effort. So you have to UV complete Higgs inversion, or you have to think a bit more about the entirety issue of Higgs inversion.
Well, except it's not, you're saying it's not happening in inflation because inflation phi dot is kind of designed to be small because you're making things roll slowly. But you're saying that after
but
inflation
my,
ends.
Okay. Yeah. After inflation,
so after inflation ends, phi dot is large. And then you have to be very careful you don't cross the cutoff when it starts to roll quickly.
And my point is that, you know, actually, the reheating temperature is pretty important because that determines in the end the number of the E4s, right? And that in turn will affect the inflationary predictions like NS and the tensor to scale ratio are dependent on the number of the E4 lengths. Like, you know, people usually take it to be between 15 and 16. But, you know, in order to really fix that parameter, you have to really study the reheating. But then the Higgs inversion, you cannot just study the reheating. So my point is that unless you sort of UV complete the Higgs inversion, you cannot make any prediction about inflation parameters of the Higgs inversion. I mean, we know that it should be like between 50 and 60, but you can't really pin down the point.
But from that point of view, the you know, that's no worse than any other kind of inflation, right? Because no other kinds of inflation really do a very good job of describing reheating. So just to make sure I've understood you, you have no evidence that there's anything wrong with the self-consistent description of the inflation itself. You're saying that if you push the model into the reheating period, then you run into trouble. That's the.
Okay. So as I said, I don't care too much about the inflation dynamics because anyway, it is unitarity is violated at the inflation. So anyway, you have to sort of UV complete, you know, Higgs inflation. But once you UV complete, you can just study the inflation dynamics without UV completing model. So that is my point.
Right. So I think I agree with you that you need to UV complete. But the question is, I think there are claims and sounds quite reasonable that the sensitivity to this UV completion is small. Because basically, the reheating happens very fast. Okay, so I agree with you that, it's impossible to predict the precise number of foldings, you know, like, and improve precision, yes. At some point, you hit the wall. But basically, to get it with the precision of order one, you just don't need much. You don't need to know, you know, much about UV completion. At least there were these claims, and there were some examples of UV completion where this works, I think. Or maybe not. Actually, I haven't followed the developments, recent ones.
Actually, in the section three, I will consider one UV completion. So I will study the large and limit of Higgs inversion, and then I will actually see that unitarity is restored. But actually, that is one UV completion. So maybe I can explain that on the new.
Right, but then this number of people does not really depend much on that. You just because the reheating happens fast.
Yeah, as I said, you know. I also believe that it is at least between 50 and 60. So, you know, within that region. So, you know, if you say that is not that much, then.
No, but I think you can do more. I think you can do it with precision one, maybe, I don't know, 55 plus minus one, because it happens during one, essentially during one oscillation, okay, maybe two. But two or one oscillation does not really change e-folds.
So I think there is, you know, usually true. So, okay, so in the next slide, in the next part, I'm going to consider the UV compression by R scalar operator, the risk scalar scalar operator, and Higgs R scalar inversion model. And there are some studies on the reheating dynamics of this model, not by me, but by other groups. And they found that in the most parameter regions, yeah, indeed, it is true that the reheating is really fast. They didn't study the whole parameter region, but at least in some parameter region, they just say that the reheating is really fast. So the e-folding is like, 59 or something. So I think you are correct. You are correct.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So I'll suggest we move on to the next part, just because,
We're running out of time. Yeah. Okay. I don't know where to, okay. Okay, so we can move on to this section three. So here, as I said, the style of the talk is a bit different from previous. It's more like TFT-ish. And here, my main question, which I want to answer, is the following. So I want to study a bit more about the Higgs inversion, the utility structure of Higgs inversion, because I'm motivated by this preheating dynamics. But then the main question is the following. So trivial utility of Higgs inversion is violated at this scale. That's what we saw. But there are actually two known facts. The first fact is that you can compute a beta function with the C parameter. In particular, you can compute the one loop vacuum polarization diagram of the graviton. And that is divergence, so you have to introduce counter terms. And the most important counter term, I will say, is this R scale operator. Okay? So you have to introduce this counter term, alpha times R scale operator. And after the renormalization, of course, this alpha runs according to the beta function, and that is computed, that is known. And the beta function is given by this formula. Okay, so here, the important point is that, again, there is a C scale term here. So if C is really large, then this is really large. So this indicates that alpha is naturally of order C scale. That is much larger than one. Okay, and because this is beta function, even if you take alpha to be zero at some specific scale, it is inevitably induced at other scales. Okay, and once you treat this R scale operator as a zero solar term, then this R scale operator is a higher derivative operator. So it induces an additional degree of freedom. Actually, that is a scalar degree of freedom. So people call that degree of freedom as the scalar. And the scalar mass is inversely proportional to alpha. Okay. So this means that if alpha is really large, then there exists a light scalar. The mass scale of this scalar is of order M Planck divided by C, naturally. And that is sort of the same as the Galois scale and the inversion scale. So yeah.
Sorry, in a sense, this is right. Here. Yes. So this is what, I'm sorry to interrupt, and we don't have a lot of time, but the scalar on, I mean, if I go to the Einstein frame, there is just gravity and the Higgs. So why, where does the extra degree of freedom come from?
So if you have the R scale, okay, so that is a good question, excellent question. In that case, if you perform the, as I said, the kinetic term becomes non-trivial, right?
Yeah, so but case, if canonically you, normalized, there is a
no,
way
no, no. People know how to do that. No, that if you have more than one field, then you cannot completely canonically normalize all the scalar fields. That is the key point. Or in other words, you can compute, as I said, you can compute the curvature from this target space metric, okay? And that is non-zero, actually. So that means that you cannot find a coordinate transformation that makes this metric completely flat, because curvature is invariant under the field definitions. So if you have only one scalar field, then you can always canonically normalize all the fields. But if you have more than one, let's say two scalar fields, then you cannot canonically normalize all the fields.
But the question really still stands. Yeah, but the question still stands. Where does the extra degree?
Can I rephrase Mina's question? Because the way you get a scalar field at a scalar degree of freedom out of a curvature squared term is that you're really saying that the curvature squared term is competing with the lower derivative terms. And so you've violated the effective field theory organization of the derivatives. And so normally what you would have said in...
Sorry, so that's why, So that's why I said that if you treat this as a zero solar term, because usually in terms of the effective theory, usually this is just a higher derivative operator. So you don't treat this as a zero solar term. But if you use this Laplacian trick, and actually you can treat this as a zero solar term, and then not the other higher derivative operators are suppressed by the Laplacian. Well, okay, I want to use this limit.
I'm probably very conservative, but I would say that in any kind of a thing where you're talking about quantum mechanics and gravity, you're really forced to organize things using an effective field theory, because otherwise you have no control over the quantum corrections. But if you're doing that, then what you're really learning from this is where your cutoff is, because if you ever got to the point where the R squared term was competing with the other terms, then you're really saying that your lone energy expansion is breaking down. And so and maybe this is not inconsistent with what you're going to say,
I think I can say two things about this. So first of all, I don't say that actually that this nonlinear coupling is gravity, because you can always go to the Einstein frame actually. And in Einstein, all the informations are just included in this term. So there's nothing related to the gravity.
I agree, I think that's a red herring though, because if we had just had a scalar, forget gravity, suppose we had a scalar field and I wrote down a derivative of the scalar to the fourth, ahead of a higher derivative term
indeed
for the then I could also get a funny propagation mode, because you're basically saying that the pole of the propagator is no longer set by k squared equals something. You've got a quartic equation in k squared, so there's more roots. And so the thing is, what you're, but that always relies on treating a derivative term as being competitive with the lower derivative terms. And that's normally the sign that your effective theory breaks down, right?
No, I think, so you can study. So for instance, this is quite similar to the Owen non-ESC model, right? Because the Owen non-ESC model also has the non-trivial target space metric. But then you can study the theory by using the large end limit, not by using the standard EFD, like a derivative expansion, but using the large end limit. And I just want to do the same thing here.
Sure, do all that. But the thing is, and I'm on board with everything until, but then you say that you need this cutoff. You need this counter term, which is R squared. And that's the point where you forced yourself to talk about the higher derivative terms. And that's where you need the effective theory to organize your quantum correction.
My point is that this beta alpha is proportional to NS. But if you consider R to the cube and R to the fourth or whatever other higher derivative operators, then they are not proportional to NS. So that's my point.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. The thing is that if you take any kind of a gravitational theory and you ask, give me a random graph and I power count it, and you ask, why is a semi-classical analysis valid, which is what you're essentially doing, then it's the derivative expansion that matters, not a 1 over n expansion. And so the thing is that as soon as you write down a higher derivative term, they're all there because, as you say, they arise from normalization. But the thing is that the control of your approximations is requiring the derivative to be small compared to the coefficients of things like R squared.
I don't think so.
You know, there are books written on this. So the thing is that the burden would be on you to show that the semi-classical expansion hasn't broken down. It may not change your conclusions.
In this slide, I will discuss these diagrams explicitly. So maybe after that, we can
discuss. Think the statement that in the presence of another large parameter like n, the power counting can be modified. Yeah, so some diagrams are enhanced by n and some others
are
not.
It can, but it doesn't remove the derivative expansion. The large n expansion is normally in addition to and not replacing the derivative expansion. As far as I know, there's no other way of understanding
For example, when models in 2+1 dimensions that are...
2+1 dimensions isn't... There's no ultraviolet, really.
No, 2+1 is not bad. Not 1+1, but 2+1. And there are those that are normalized at large n.
Show
me one in 4 dimensions.
Maybe we should let Yohei finish his talk because it's like 5 minutes to time and probably he actually still wants to tell us what he wants to tell us. And then we have a discussion. Then we have discussion after the talk if that's okay with everybody.
I have to go to bed.
Thank you. So, sorry for interrupting.
Sorry, please, before you go to bed, reply to my message, please. Sorry.
Okay, I'll check my mail.
I try my best to make it short. This is known, like a beta function implies that there exists alpha features of order xi scale. And then if you treat this as a zeroth order Lagrangian, so there might be a debate. I think in the Lagrangian limit, it is just five, but we can discuss later. There is another fact. So once you have the scalar, actually the scalar lifts the cutoff scale to M Planck. So scalar actually UV completes Higgs inversion. So that is known, and that is actually said by me, but confirmed by other people. And so if you combine these two facts, then you may ask the following question, maybe the quantum correction to the rescue of the trivial integral of Higgs inversion. Because once you include the quantum corrections, then you will induce the alpha phases of the xi scale. And once you have the scalar, and then you can just restore the integral. So I wanted to study the quantum correction in a controlled way. So I want to rely on some approximation, of course, and I will use the large n limit, as I said. And in this slide, I'm going to study the scattering amplitude because I think that is the best way of seeing the utility. So, and I want to take the ns to be infinity, and this ratio is fixed. That is kind of a half limit, I believe. And in this limit, the leading order diagrams are given by vacuum polarization diagrams. So previously, we had only this trivial amplitude. But now, because we are taking a large NS limit, so we have this diagram. And here, the NS scalar fields are propagating within this loop. So you will pay like couplings here and here, or some, Xi divided by M Planck, here and here, but that is compensated by the NS here coming from this loop. So this is actually of order comparable to the tree level amplitude. And the same is true for other diagrams. And so if you consider, for instance, other diagrams, like if you consider additional graviton here, for instance, that one loop, and that will induce the other operators than the R scalar operator. But then that is suppressed compared to this diagram because you no longer get any NS factor from this loop. So this is the reading on the terms.
Is it just the renormalization of the scalar curvature that sources the graviton propagator?
So this one?
Yes.
So this one is the, so you have to introduce the counter.
Meta fields, the loops of meta fields feed back.
Yes, loops of meta fields. Einstein gravity, and also the you will induce additional terms like R scalar operator and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. And let's study the forward scattering amplitude of this system because that is the best way, I believe, of seeing the integrity. And here I'm going to just focus on the flavor singlet state like this. So you can just choose whatever state you want, but here I'm going to just focus on this flavor singlet state. I mean, that is given by this, like, that is just a summation of phi 1, phi 1, phi 2, phi 2, phi 3, phi 3, and so on and so forth. Okay. And you can compare the scattering amplitude, for a scattering amplitude, and that is given by this expression. Because you now have NS scalar number of diagonal components, like a phi 1, phi 1 can go to phi 2, phi 2, or phi 3, phi 3, phi 4, phi 4. But you have only NS number of diagonal components. So the off-diagonal amplitudes are more important than the diagonal one. So that's why here I and J are different. And then you have NS scalar number of such kind of off-diagonal components, and that should be divided by this normal state. So you will get NS here. So this is the result of the leading order in large NS, okay? And you can perform a partial wave expansion of this amplitude because I want to check the partial wave integrity. And then the result is something like this, okay? So I'm gonna focus on the spin zero sector because only the spin zero sector depends on C. So the amplitude is given by this. So this is coming from a tree level contribution. And then you may actually see that if you divide this one loop part by the tree level part, then you can sort of extract this one loop amplitude, sort of this vacuum polarization part. And then I think that this sounds really hand waving, but actually it is true if you study the coefficient of the partial wave expansion. So this part and this one is given by tree level amplitude times one loop divided by tree level amplitude. If you have two, then you have to just square this ratio. And if you resum over all those kind of diagrams, all those contributions, then you will get a structure in the denominator or minus something like this. Yeah. And you can just expand this expression and you will get this. And you can also take the imaginary part of the one with amplitude and that is equivalent to cutting this diagram and you will get just the tree of amplitude scale. And as a result, you will get this, okay? And by combining this one, and actually you can show that the imaginary part of this, let's say dressed amplitude is equal to the dressed amplitude scalar itself. So the elastic integrity is exactly satisfied in this model. In this amplitude. Okay, so what happens is that if you focus only on the tree level amplitude, then the integrity was violated at the M Planck level of C, the scale. But once you include all those vacuum polarization diagrams, actually the integrity is restored. And I have to say that it is not me who first pointed out this kind of features. It is discussed by these papers. They phrase this mechanism as the self-healing mechanism. So I will just follow that terminology. Okay.
Sorry to interrupt, but just to be able to follow. So here, scalaron is important in this argument.
That's my point in the following. Good. In the next slide, in the next two slides, I will explain that. So here, what I want to do is that, so in my opinion, so these people are really concerned his impression and study that, but these people just computed this and then show that the elastic integrity is exactly satisfied. I didn't really completely understand what's going on. So I wanted to understand a bit more about what's going on physically, they say. So that was the main motivation of my paper, actually. So the question is how to understand this physically. in order to understand what's going on this physically, then I think it is really important to notice that the drift amplitude actually develops a pole. Okay, so the drift amplitude is given by this formula. So you have this structure in the denominator. Okay, and one of the amplitude divided by derivative amplitude is proportional to S, the Mandelson variable, because it is sort of non-renormalizable theory, let's say. So this in particular means that the drift amplitude has this kind of structure. Okay, 1 minus S divided by M squared. So you will get a pole. And from the locality of the KFT, we know that if you have a pole in the amplitude, then there must be a corresponding degree of freedom that is propagating as an intermediate state. And so a new degree of freedom kind of emerges due to summation, and that unitarizes the theory. So that is sort of the physical understanding. I would say that the similar phenomena are observed for other models within Large N, in the case of the Large N. I don't know whether this is the oldest example, but at least the Nambu and the Yonarashino discussed such kind of stuff. Like, they started from full family interaction and they did what they called a ladder approximation, but that is actually equivalent to the Large N limit. And they got some poles in their Green functions and that they identified as pions and other mesons. Or you can do the same for the ON on ES model. And then if you perform this, and then you will get a single meson that sort of unitarizes. So that is the radial direction of the sphere, and that unitarizes the theory. Or if you know the word hidden local symmetry, the story is the same there. Like you can start from CP NOS Mandelson model, and then you will get warm mesons. Or even some people apply this to the electric chiral polarization theory. And my point in my paper is that this pole can be actually identified as a scatter in the case of a Higgs impression. So that is my main point. And in order to see that it is really the same as a scatter, so it is easy, just to compute. So that's what I did. So first of all, the drift amplitude is given by this formula. So it looks really complicated, but you can, for instance, just ignore this imaginary part. And then there is a one minus one. So this means that there exists actually a pole in this amplitude. And here alpha is given by this formula. So actually, as I said, the vacuum polarization diagram is divergent. So you have to introduce the counter term. That is actually the R scale operator. And then this alpha is just the coefficient of that counter term. So that is given by this. And then here, maybe I can mention that this lambda alpha is just a parameter choice of the theory. So it is just the same as the dimensional transmutation, or the same as the lambda QCD. So because this alpha runs according to the beta function, so we have to specify the boundary condition. And that is equivalent to say that this alpha vanishes at some specific energy scale, and that is given by this lambda. So this is just a parameter choice of the theory. And in order to see that this drift amplitude is really the same as the amplitude with the scalar, you can just start from a theory with the scalar from the beginning, like this. And this R scale operator, as I said, is a higher derivative operator. So there is an additional degree of freedom. So you can extract that degree of freedom by using the so-called auxiliary field method. And you can do the computation in whatever frame you want. They're all equivalent. But in my opinion, it is easiest to go to the conformal frame, where the Higgs and scalar are conformally coupled to the gravity. So in that case, the kinetic terms are completely flat, and you will just get this potential, this interaction between sigma. Sigma is the scalar, actually, that is coming from this R scale operator originally, and the phi scale. So in particular, this potential has a sigma phi I scale interaction, like a trilinear interaction. So with that interaction, you can compute a four-point scattering amplitude, phi angle to phi j with the R scale term. And then you will get an initial additional contribution coming from the scalar. So you can just include this contribution, you can just compute the trilinear amplitude. And then actually you can show that the drift amplitude is equal to the trilinear amplitude. Once you identify alpha is equal to alpha bar. And here, because of this, I will say that the new degree of freedom can be identified as the scalar. Okay, so here, this identification is actually non-trivial because, you have 1 degree of freedom, so you can always tune or match the position of the pole, but not only the position of the pole, but also the residue of the pole of the scattering amplitude. That is, of course, the equivalent to the coupling between the Higgs and the scalar. Actually, that also matches. And moreover, this imaginary part is actually coming from the decay rate of the scalar, because if you have the imaginary part in your propagator, and that is corresponding to the decay rate, right? And you can compute the decay rate of the scalar within this theory, and you can actually see that that is equal to this. So by identifying alpha is equal to alpha bar, we can match 3 different quantities, the position of the pole, residue of the pole, and the imaginary part of the pole. So I think it is really non-trivial. So we can say the new freedom is countable. So that's what I did. And then, okay, so I don't think I can, so I don't have any enough time to explain this point in detail, but actually there is something more, some more interesting story than what I explained. And then we wrote a paper about this. So actually we can elaborate the correspondence between OM nonlinear model and Higgs impression a bit more. Okay, and I can just mention this in this slide, and then, if you are interested, you can ask me later. So in the case of my own nonlinear model, you have low energy degree of freedom, and there is pions. And then correspondingly, the Higgs impression, you can identify the low energy degrees of freedom as the Higgs field, and also the conform mode of the metric, that is the determinant part of the metric. And actually the inclusion of this term is really important, because once you include this term, then the definition of your target space is frame independent. So like, you know, people usually say like Jordan frame, you have nonlinear coupling, and the Einstein frame, you don't have any nonlinear coupling, but the press to pace that you have some non-trivial kinetic time and so on and so forth. So different frame, if you go to different frames, the physics looks different. But if you include the conform model of the metric, then actually you're including this model target space, the definition of the target space becomes completely frame independent. So you don't have to consider what happens in the Jordan frame, what happens in the Einstein frame. So you can just treat everything at the same time. So that is the main point of it. And that is the point of the including this degree of freedom. And target space are given by this. And once you define, so in the case of OM nonlinear model, we know that the Sigma Meson completely flattens the target space. Like it is a radial direction, and that completely flattens the target space of OM nonlinear model. And correspondingly, in the case of the Higgs impression, you can see that once you define a target space, including conform mode of the metric, then the scalar actually completely flattens the target space metric without any even the Planck surface operator. So in that sense, that we can really identify the scalar as a Sigma Meson. And this is equivalent to say that you can start from the action with the R scalar operator in the Jordan frame, let's say, and you can perform the auxiliary field introduction to extract the scalar degree of freedom from this R scalar operator, and also you can perform a phi transformation, and you can actually go to the conformal frame where phi and sigma are conformally coupled to the Ricci scalar. And the fact that the scalar completely flattens the target space defined by phi I and phi is equivalent to say that in this conformal frame, the scalar, the kinetic term of the scalar and the Higgs are completely flat. Okay, so here actually in this conformal frame, you can completely canonically normalize all the scalar fields, including the scalar. Okay, and also the potential includes only the up to the quadratic interactions. So this identification is really equivalent to say on this. And I don't have any time to explain that in more details, but I'm more than happy to provide more details later if you want. Okay, so I'm gonna summarize my talk. So first of all, in the section two, I saw that the Higgs impression virus is neutrality of brain impression during pre-epoch. So I wanted to study a bit more about the neutrality issue of Higgs impression. And actually Higgs impression said Higgs neutrality of the gen. This is not said by me, but by other people. I wanted to understand what's going on. And I interpret this as the sort of the emergence of the scalar. So you actually have the scalar degree of freedom that is propagating. And then with that, you can get the same amplitude. So this in particular means that Higgs impression is actually sort of an Higgs R scalar model, at least if you believe the large N limit. So this UV completion is natural in the sense that if you use the large N limit, then this UV completion is sort of naturally kind of picked up. And with this R scalar operator, preheating can be studied without any unitarity issue because it lifts the cutoff scale to the M Planck. And also it is known as scalar and smear spiky features. The preheating dynamics of this model, Higgs R scalar model is studied by different groups. Not me, but the different groups. And they saw that scalar and smear also spiky features. Okay, so I think that's it. That's all what I want to say. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Yohei. A virtual applause. Thank you so much. We already had some discussion during the talk, but if there's anything people want to ask now in record, feel free to do so. Otherwise, we stop recording and then.
So go ahead. So instead of a large NS, you can you use Xi? Xi is a large parameter as well. And I think it also enhances these bubble amplitudes. Yeah.
Yes, actually, I agree. I agree. So here I use the large N limit, but I'm not completely sure whether this large N limit is needed, or maybe we can just use the large C and that's it. And that might be enough. Yeah, I agree. So yeah, it is true that if you have the large C parameter, then you always have the enhanced R-scale operator. But once you have the R-scale operator, and as I said, it is unitarized. So that means that once you treat this R-scale operator as sort of the zeroth order term, then all the other higher derivative operators are suppressed, not by M Planck divided C, but suppressed by just M Planck. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, I agree. Indeed, that sort of indicates that maybe large C limit is just enough for this analysis. But yeah, here I just relied on large N, but maybe that was a bit too much. I agree.
Okay, if nobody else has a question, then I also have another question.
So, I'm just waiting for them to turn the recording off, that's all.
My question is about this conformal mode phi. So yeah, when you make this analogy with nonlinear signal model. So yeah, I didn't get what this phi is. Phi is not dynamical before you introduce the scalaron. So
okay.
Isn't it the same as the scalaron? Isn't phi equal sigma eventually?
So actually, I have backup slides, several backup slides on this point. So if you want to know a bit more details, I can explain. But maybe it will take some time. Like, I don't know.
So how about I stop? I think we should stop recording now so Josh can leave the call if he wants to. But yeah, once again, let's thank Yohei.
Thank you.